Because healthcare is essential, many observers have viewed the growing influence of large companies in the industry, a process known as corporatization, with alarm. But although some critics yearn for a return to a purely professional ethos, such a reversal might be impractical and irresponsible. I'm Stephen Morrissey, managing editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, and I'm talking with Amitabh Chandra, a professor of public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government and a professor of business administration at Harvard Business School. Professor Chandra has co-authored a perspective article about the trade-offs involved in corporatization as part of the journal's series on the corporatization of U.S. healthcare. Professor Chandra, broadly, what factors typically lead to corporatization in a market?
At its core, corporatization in healthcare rises because healthcare organizations need to grow. And to grow, they need money. And the money comes from capital markets. So, in other words, it comes from wealthy families, it comes from investors, it comes from pension funds. But when you get that money, the folks who gave us the money to grow also want a share of our profits. So that's the deal with corporatization.
You mentioned several entities. What entities have typically been investors in U.S. healthcare deals?
There's been a very wide range of investors. Recently, if one reads the newspaper, one might think that the only really large investor are private equity funds. Private equity funds are one type of investor. And just to be clear, private equity funds themselves represent other people. So I'm sure that lots of us who are listening to this call invest in companies that are backed by private equity companies or have pension funds invested in private equity companies. Another source of capital would be venture capitalists. Another source would be the companies themselves. So if you take a large corporate entity like UnitedHealthcare will use a lot of its revenues to acquire other companies that need capital to grow. So there's just a lot of different sources of capital in healthcare, sovereign wealth funds, very wealthy families. It's a fairly diverse mix of people.
Unlike in standard markets, you say in your article that in the healthcare market, profits and value often don't align. So why is that? What's the reason for the lack of alignment?
I think that what happens with corporatization is that it certainly creates value for the companies providing the capital and the companies receiving the capital. So for investors and companies, it creates value. It's not always clear that corporatization is value creating for those who are not part of the deal. So who's not in the deal? Very often, patients may not be in the deal, or the government may not be part of the deal. So sometimes corporatization can help patients. Sometimes it can help government. Sometimes it can help parties that are not in the deal. And that would be wonderful. And there's other times when it could be good for investors and companies, but not so good for patients and families.
Are there examples of healthcare sectors in which corporatization might be especially likely to increase prices without a parallel increase in quality or other social benefits?
I think the place that I tend to look at is nursing homes. And let me explain why I want to go straight to nursing homes. Corporatization does not always work well. It carries risks when the quality of care is hard to observe, or when patients are vulnerable, or when the corporate entity is very, very large, and so there's not a lot of competition. So, in the nursing home sector, what we've seen across a number of research papers is that private equity acquisitions of nursing homes result in nursing homes avoiding sicker patients. So, right there, the sicker patients don't benefit from corporatization in the nursing home industry. And that the nursing homes themselves, who now have less sick patients, are offering lower quality care. So, even the people who are in the nursing homes don't benefit from the infusion of capital from private equity companies. And just to be clear, the measure of quality that I'm using is patient mortality. So this is an area where I think because the patients are vulnerable, not able to observe quality directly, corporatization carries risks.
And then on the flip side, what about sectors where corporate ownership might have positive effects?
Yeah, so let's talk about two of those sectors, Stephen. One is it's a relatively small sector of healthcare, but it illustrates my point about how profits can be both the fuel and the fault line of corporate purpose. So let's talk about where profits may be the fuel of corporate purpose. And let's talk about the IVF, in vitro fertilization industry. It's incredibly capital intensive. There are enormous setup costs of building these facilities, building the labs. But it's also true that expanding my care to one more patient is relatively cheap. The larger companies can share data that they can learn from, which allows them to optimize the complex cycle of stimulating ovaries, retrieving eggs, fertilizing those eggs, testing the embryo, doing the cultures, and finally doing the implantation. You can learn a lot from scale. Outcomes are easily measurable, right? Like I can look at the success rate of different IVF clinics to tell who's the better one. So IVF is a place where corporatization has actually created a lot of value, I think, for folks not involved directly in the corporatization. In other words, it's benefited families, it's benefited parents. And so I think it works when patients can observe quality and shop around. And so my sense is you can learn from corporatization in IVF and say that those lessons might apply to eye surgery, to dentistry, perhaps to dermatology. There's another example where I think corporatization works as well. Let's talk about a very controversial sector, biopharma. Biopharma, in many ways, does embody successful corporatization. That industry is extremely capital intensive. Just to put that into perspective, this is one of the most R&D intensive industries in the world. It does about $275 billion of R&D every year. No single company has $275 billion of revenue to plow into R&D. Novartis's total revenues are about $50 billion. Amgen's total revenues are $30 billion. So how does the industry get $275 billion? It accesses capital markets. So it goes to investors, it goes to venture capitalists, it goes to my pension fund or my retirement account and raises capital. Now, why does corporatization work in biopharma? One reason is that doctors can tell whether the medicine works, patients can tell whether the medicine works. Maybe not perfectly, but certainly more perfectly than in the nursing home industry. But very importantly, we have a very powerful regulator whose imprimatur is necessary. So I'm thinking of the FDA. The FDA has to say this medicine is safe and effective for the medicine to be able to be marketed. So, in other words, I think the presence of this very strong regulator helps this market and consequently corporatization to rank positively in terms of whether it's creating social value or not.
You say in your article that corporatization isn't the only tool that medical firms can use to raise capital. What are the alternative sources and why are they sufficient or insufficient?
There are alternative sources. I mean, let's go back to what is corporatization. Like I said, it's a deal. It's a deal between companies that want to grow and investors who have capital that can help them grow, but those investors want profits. So rather than companies going to investors and saying, I'll sign a deal with you, these companies could also go to the government. And the government could fund the growth of healthcare organizations. I am just a lot less sure that governments are able to do this for two reasons. The first is the government has no incentive to select good investments given bureaucratic hurdles and the lack of incentive. So a government official, however hardworking they are, doesn't participate in the upside of getting it right. But they certainly will be headlined in the local newspaper if they got it wrong, which makes them very, very risk averse. I also think that governments are extremely sensitive to shifting political climates, which make government an extremely unreliable funder for long-term investments. I mean, we've seen the government really recently withdraw from its role as a funder of basic science research. And so that type of capricious funding is not good if you're trying to build a business over 10, 20, 30 years. That's one reason that I think the government model is insufficient. There is another model. The other model would be to turn to nonprofits. So the nonprofit model would be like a lot of the hospitals that we have in the United States. They're corporations too. They're financed by donations. They're also financed by taxpayers because we don't collect taxes from nonprofit healthcare organizations. I think there's a role, important role for nonprofits. However, the challenge with nonprofits is they're just too small. There is just no nonprofit in the world that could finance even a tenth of the biopharma R&D that needs to be done. So first, they're just really, really small. And second, ultimately, the performance of nonprofits is far from automatic. Just because they're nonprofits doesn't mean that they're less rapacious in how they price than for-profits. Ultimately, the nonprofit decision-making is only as good as the management or governance of the nonprofit. So I think simply because an organization is a nonprofit doesn't mean that it is going to be less rapacious in the profits it demands than the for-profit-oriented investors.
So you talked about the value of a strong regulator like the FDA, and then you also talked about the limits of government involvement in all of this. So final question, what steps can policymakers and regulators take to harness the potential benefits of corporatization, but limit its harmful effects?
I think there's an exceptionally powerful role for regulation in healthcare. So let me start by saying that we need regulators to be able to enforce quality standards, just like we have seen with the FDA. So just like the FDA has a powerful role, omniscient role in regulating drugs as being safe and effective, we need much more of that type of enforcement in healthcare, especially for vulnerable patients who may not be able to shop around for the best care. The second is we also need regulation to limit monopoly power by hospitals, by physician groups, by health insurers. So when competition starts to break down, the very large entity that's supplying healthcare can charge very high prices that could damage patients' well-being. And so we need to ensure a competitive environment. So there is a very active role for regulation. Now, I think a lot of people might say, well, what about getting the government to measure quality better? And I support that enterprise very much so. But just to be clear, it's also very hard to measure quality in a robust manner. There are hundreds and hundreds of quality measures, the vast majority of which are just sort of like measurement activities as opposed to really reflecting the quality of care that patients receive. So if it's possible to measure quality, or when quality measurement is straightforward as it is in the IVF industry, I think we should measure it. We don't really know how to measure quality extremely well in the nursing home industry. So there, simply saying we should measure quality better may not be a sufficient answer.
Thank you, Professor Chandra.